Our kids are feeling the pressures of school. How can we help them learn better by creating classrooms where they learn a little more slowly? Welcome to SDPB's Teacher Talk. I'm Lori Walsh. On Halloween night, I stood at the front door of my house ready to pass out candy and treats. Now, most of the trick-or-treaters this year in my neighborhood were a bit on the older side. They were probably in middle school or even early high school. And the most coveted prize from my treat bowl this year was the stress ball. I was surprised at how excited kids became when offered a palm-sized ball of foam or gel to squeeze in their hands and release a little tension. If my costume neighbors are any indication, a slower pace might do everyone some good. Well, teachers feel that stress too. For this week's Teacher Talk, Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur consider the idea of slow school. Jackie has been doing some research. Slowing down school.
Yes, please.
Yes, please, Jackie. You were the person to write about this because you've done some research, some travel, and a lot of thinking about the pace of school. Tell us a little bit about why you're reflecting on that lately.
I have always reflected on the pace of school. Mm. I was the type of student who just perpetually felt rushed. I never finished my lunch during the lunch break. I always had to take the assignments home with me because I didn't get them done in the allotted class time. I was running late to school. I was lingering after school. You know, yeah. I'm the kind of person that I move slowly. And so school, the pace of school perpetually felt rushed to me. And I feel like this is now something that people are talking about much more. It's a more common topic. And since I've been thinking about it for a long time, I wanted to talk about it with both of you.
I'm wondering if it's measurable.
Great question. I don't know the answer to that.
Can we quantify how the pace of school or the expectations have changed over time?
Mm-hmm.
Or has it always been fast and it's all, you know, it just feels fast to some people and not to others?
Really good question. Yeah. Though one measure, I don't know the answer, but it does make me think that I stumbled upon, you know how when you go to kindergarten, your kid has to do like a kindergarten readiness situation, and they showed what the kindergarten readiness standards were in the 60s, mm-hmm. and they were very different from what they are today, but I don't know that they would necessarily be quantified as faster or slower.
Right. I have, the expectation has changed. So my, I have my, in a scrapbook, my like kindergarten report card, and it has a piece of paper, and I was supposed to cut along the line. And now I can't, I mean, that's probably something they definitely preschool now.
Yeah.
Kindergartners probably aren't being measured on whether they can cut along a straight line. They're doing coding prompts.
Yeah. And I'm thinking it could be quantifiable, but who has done it, right? Like it, you would look at how minutes in a class, at the high school level, how are the minutes being utilized during a class? How many tasks are students having to complete?
Right.
But who's done that measurement?
Right.
I'm sure some researcher right now is screaming into the void because they have
it.
Let us
know.
yes.
Tell us.
All this is us opening our eyes to a question we don't know and saying, now we're going to start paying attention to how that is quantified. And yeah, if you're measuring the outcome, the expectations, or the actual pace. And, you know, how many minutes are spent here, how many minutes are spent there. We know intuitively that it's been squeezed because we don't have time for sustained silent reading. And that's, you know, a big deal. Or you don't have time for a recess or art. Or so we know. We just don't have the study in front of us. We'll find some stuff.
Yes.
But I'm curious to go back to just essential of you feeling rushed. Because that's the way I was, too. I always felt the bell would ring and I would, some kids would be out the door and I'd be like, putting my book in my, still closing my book, and where's my pencil go, and feeling flustered by that.
100%. That is how I felt. I would be amazed by the students who were eating their lunch, done, had it in the garbage can. I feel like I just opened my sandwich. Just the kind of person I was and still am.
And you still feel like everything is accelerating.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. I feel like the world is whizzing by me all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you have some experience with, I mean, Gina, do you feel the same thing? I feel like every week we need to check in on the cell phone ban how it's showing up in our school.
Where I was going to go with it. Somebody asked me, what's the biggest difference you've noticed? And I said, I'm seeing students who are just being still. Mm-hmm. And at high school, that looks different from elementary, where people are fidgeting and literally moving around the room. Mm-hmm. But I see high school students just sitting in their desks, and I can see that they're just thinking or giving their brain a little rest. But it's okay to be still now because you don't have people around you who are grabbing technology to keep them busy.
Yeah.
Everyone is just like, well, there's nothing to grab, so I'm just going to sit here. And you know what? I think what's happening is things are allowed time to soak in, and we're getting deeper experiences rather than a bunch of surfaced experiences.
Fascinating. So do you feel rushed in school?
I can.
These two things can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
That the phones are helping add reflection. The phone ban on cell phones is helping add time of just reflecting and thinking or zoning
stillness.
Out.
Yeah.
But you can also, as a teacher, feel like things are accelerating and the expectations and the pressures on students are going fast.
I think I have the autonomy where I can slow it down in my classroom.
Okay.
So I can't speak for all teachers, but I'm doing my best to slow it down. And honestly, a big part of that is removing technology whenever possible, becoming more of an unplugged classroom, if you will.
Yeah.
My own colleagues who teach the same level of English that I teach, we've all started having our students handwrite more.
Okay.
And we've found that students are taking more time. You see them look up to the ceiling and think, and we're getting better responses.
Mm.
And a study recently came out, 2024, that says handwriting creates more connections in the brain than typing does. Because
mm-hmm.
typing is just the same movement over and over. Just tap, right. tap, 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 tap. But handwriting is a whole different thing that's causing the brain to fire. So,
and I want to know about reading, too, because here's a parent memory.
Yeah.
Middle school, a teacher who came his first year teaching, and he had assigned a certain amount of, you know, science reading. And I had asked him at conferences, you know, I said, that took a few hours, like what helped me understand what your expectation is for the reading. And he said, well, I don't want them to read it. I want them to learn how to scan. I've given them too much. And as a parent, I was like, I'm listening to you, but I'm not agreeing with that mm-hmm. because I'm teaching her the opposite, mm-hmm. which is in-depth reading the science article is something she needs to comprehend. And you're saying she should just be pulling away bullet notes and scanning. So you teach literature.
I'm on your side there, Lori, for sure, because just scanning means you can be caught up in assumptions rather than really having the deep understanding of whatever is being said. You can be caught up in a headline rather than having that deep understanding. And I did implement independent reading in my class this year, which mm-hmm. I had gone away from for a long time, but it helped with the cell phone ban. Mm-hmm. And I've also heard that libraries are getting more books checked out with phones being banned, and I'm not having any trouble with my students actually sitting there and reading, or at least they look like they're reading.
Right.
I don't have to do any classroom management.
So, Jackie, tell me some of the things that you went looking for as far as other people who are talking about slowing down school or making it a reasonable, more humane pace. Mm-hmm. What did you find? Yeah.
Well, one of the folks that I've been interested in for a while is Ted Dentersmith. He wrote the book What Schools Could Be and has kind of a network of the similar like-minded folks who are having these conversations. And the thesis to that book and the work that he's doing is that focusing on standardized test scores, specifically on the narrative that American students are behind, our reading scores are behind X country, our math scores are behind what they were X number of years ago. Students should be doing blank and they're behind that. All of that kind of narrative gives the feeling of needing to hurry up or catch up. Mm-hmm. And it takes us into performance rather than the journey of learning. So that's one of the first pieces that I turned to in this conversation was just reexamining. I mean, and that's the question of his book too, is like what should we really be learning about in school? And so that I think was the starting point for me on this conversation.
And you even mentioned the curriculum that we have available in South Dakota, the Ocheti Shakowin Essential Understandings, mm-hmm. being key to rethinking education here in the state. Tell me about that.
Yes, I am excited. I learned in reading about this that anyone, just putting this out there, anyone for free can learn those standards and take courses for continuing education, which I am now planning to do. But it teaches you about Lakota, Dakota, Nakota, traditional indigenous teachings. And many of those teachings are focused here on storytelling, on culture, on learning to be more in harmony with nature and its natural pace. And so I'm very excited to delve more into those essential understandings, because I do think that it re-centers the conversation around the process of learning and what matters when we're talking about developing young people's minds.
Yeah. And you've been to Finland and seen how this works here. Remind us about that trip and what still resonates with you all these months later.
I felt so comfortable in Finland. It felt like my circadian rhythm was much better. The pace of school there felt what I would just say correct to my body. One of the things that I really appreciated, and granted, we were guests in their school, right, so I was not doing the same thing that I would be if I were being an educator there. But we would be kind of collectively as an American group, like, okay, what's the next thing? And they would be like, oh, we have snacks for you in this room. We were like, what? That's delightful. I feel like just the overall tone, and we went to several schools, the overall tone in every school was just a much more relaxed pace. That everyone was breathing a little slower, and intentionally so. The day starts a little bit later, ends a little bit earlier. There's more planning time for teachers, and it's also cultural. You know, like the entire system in Finland, people are not working as many hours, and there are a lot more social supports that allow for people to not have multiple jobs, things like that. So the collective society is not as intense, I would say, as it is here in the United States.
So Gina, you've talked before about the way you set up your classroom and, you know, the grading, how grading can be different or less grading. How do you intentionally set the pace, and are you different than other classes?
The interesting thing about teaching is that you are in your room teaching and you never really see what other teachers are doing.
Yeah.
You can make assumptions and basic observations, so I can't tell you what other people are doing. But I can tell you most teachers I know will say that they feel like they have to keep doing more and more and more and more and more. More gets put on their plate constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And the less and less and less and less we can do, I think the better we will be at our jobs. Because, again, we're having to be so surfaced on everything instead of being able to go deep.
Yeah. What are we afraid of, Jackie?
Very interesting and excellent question. I don't know if I have the answer to that, Lori. I think a lot of our society really is deeply ingrained in if you work hard, you'll make it. And so I think the idea of working hard is deeply instilled in our culture. I don't know that I have found personally that when I slow down, I work any less hard. I think that I am just being wiser about my time, and I'm taking my rest more seriously. Gina was mentioning at the beginning of this conversation that her students have time to let things sink in, and that is really when a lot of learning can happen, is when you gaze out the window and kind of let yourself digest some of what you just learned, or, you know, take a few deep breaths and move more into that relaxed state. We've talked a lot about on this show that when you're in a state of stress, your brain moves more into that fight or flight mode, and less of your brain activity is illuminated. It's more concentrated in survival mode, whereas when you're more relaxed, you can make connections and your brain is more illuminated across different parts of the mind.
Yeah.
When I taught AP English, I would tell the parents AP does not mean more homework. It means more thinking, deeper thinking.
Mm.
And I would say, don't be surprised if your student doesn't have constant homework from AP English. We are doing deep, hard thinking in class because it's more thinking, not more homework. Homework and thinking are not the same thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we have to rethink how we measure success in the classroom. And I keep coming back to this idea of long-term gains versus short-term activity.
Mm-hmm.
And And I know I've been under some stress lately. And and I'll be at home and I'll be, you know, feeling all the feelings. And I'll think, if you just keep it busy, you know, you won't feel this. And then I remind myself, but if you feel it all now, you won't carry it into the future. So go ahead and sit and stare out the window and feel all the stuff you're feeling, because this is the work that you need to be doing right now.
Yeah. Short-term pain, long-term gain.
Yeah. And that feels similar to what you're saying, that you, Gina Benz, teacher of the classroom, might not see the results of that deep thinking.
No.
But you are trusting that it matters in this moment to that student's future.
And you have to trust yourself as a teacher that you don't need constant, well, I'm just going to say it, you don't need constant assessments to tell you where your students are at. You do need some.
Right.
You do need some.
Yeah. We're not advocating for a free-for-all.
That's right. But you also can, well, I guess our assessments are constant. Like, if I'm just watching, I don't have to take a piece of paper and put a grade on it for it to be an assessment.
Right.
And so, yeah, you trust yourself as a teacher that you know what you're doing.
What you said, Lori, reminded me of our brain research conversation and just a very quick overview of one of the things that you're making me think of is that your brain has four different waves to it. Well, it's more complicated than that, but basically you have the alpha, beta, theta, and delta waves, the alpha being the highest frequency and then the delta being the slowest frequency. And people who are regularly in states of stress, who spend most of their time kind of in those alpha high frequency waves and don't spend as much time in delta waves, will kind of recalibrate so that they don't really ever drop into those deep levels of relaxation that you would experience in deep sleep or in practices of deep relaxation. And those waves are what remind you about your own needs and the needs of others. And so you're not wrong that when you say, like, oh, when I stay busy, I kind of forget about my own feelings or my own needs. That is actually what does happen, where you'll just kind of recalibrate on this higher frequency and a more consistent state of stress. So that is part of brain research, what you're saying right there.
I feel like you should repeat that 10 times.
I'm kind of mad at you for reminding me of all those things. And you point out in your blog too, Jackie, that there are other areas that are exploring this, food.
Oh my gosh. I read so much about the slow food movement. I can't even tell you. I was completely fascinated. But that is actually the origin to all slow movements, to my understanding, is the slow food movement. And it started as a protest in Italy to the first fast food joint that was established in Rome. And so people protested. I don't know what fast food establishment it was, but people protested there being fast food in Rome at all. And that movement has grown then into other sectors of society. But the initial movement of slow food was to say food does not need to be fast. It robs it of its nutritional value. It robs us of our cultural practices. It takes away the humanity and the purpose of food altogether. And then they have just a litany of reasons why having slow food is better for the environment, better for people, better for culture. Their website, the movement, has so many resources. Like I said, I spent a long time on there, just really fascinated. Yeah. But I think it can be then extrapolated to other areas of society. And when I was in serving as a public librarian, I read a lot about slow librarianship. And librarians, I think it surprises no one, really embrace that idea. But it's like holding on to the fact that the library too can be an area that where you don't need programming every minute of the day and you don't need to move patrons through at rapid pace. Like, this is a place where we should protect going slow.
Yeah. Gina, our friend, is so smart. Aren't we lucky? We're so lucky.
You're so nice to me. No, it's the other way around. So I'm the lucky one.
Say more. I'm sort of going to sit back and listen to you talk. Because that's
hardly
If you're a first-year teacher and you're in survival mode, what is one small way that you can think about slowing down your classroom?
I think you look at all the things you're doing and pick out what is necessary and what is extra. Focus on the what is necessary. You can have the extra in your back pocket in case you need it, but get down to what is necessary?
I would say go slow right now. Mm. Slow down this breath. Slow down this moment. And that will provide you a pause to be able to think about what to do next.
I think, too, it would be a little bit jolting to students because it's just our society of go, 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 more, more, mm-hmm. more. And so tell them what you're doing.
Yes.
I do that. I say in my classroom, we're going to slow things down because things are really busy beyond the walls of this classroom.
Yeah.
So be ready to just take a breath and think and have moments of silence.
I love that it's not get through that first year and then you'll start incorporating ways to slow down. It's slow down right now. What is essential right now? And slow down this breath. I think that's a beautiful answer.
Thank you. But I will echo what Gina just said. I've gotten that feedback from many people that it can be hard to be in a space that I control because it is slow to many people, right? If you're the kind of person who's like, why is this person 10 steps behind me? Can they mm-hmm. please hurry up? It's hard to be.
right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I know that about myself. And so accommodations and modifications for all, right? And so my fast people, I had things for them. So that way they weren't just being absolutely tortured in my space. You know what I mean?
Like what? What do you have for your fast people?
Oh, well, I mean, all the fidgets, all of the extra assignments, sure. all the accelerated things. Yeah, they need those. You know, all of the, you can do these two things at the same time kind of opportunities. Yeah, absolutely.
What mm-hmm. about the fast eaters?
Yes. Oh, the kids would eat second lunch. I was blown away. I'm like, you got two lunches done?
That's right. I forgot about that.
They would be like, I'm going to go back for second lunch. Yeah. I'm like, barely opened first lunch.
I forgot about that. I forgot how quick some of those kids would move to second lunch in the lunchroom. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they got it figured out.
They did. Yeah. Good for them. I was impressed.
Well, I think this is a beautiful column. I appreciate you sharing it with us.
It's
not about lowering expectations.
Not at all.
Yeah. If you'd like to connect more deeply with Jackie Wilbur's research this week, you can find links to everything on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. Teacher Talk is a podcast for teachers and their best friends at work, or your BFAW, and it is made by education professionals who love their jobs. Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz talk about the highs and lows of teaching and provide resources for new and experienced teachers. Dr. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. She serves as director of the Center for Student and Professional Services there. Gina Benz is an adjunct faculty member at several universities and a recipient of the Milken Educator Award. She's been teaching for more than 25 years. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.